Commander Burleson had taken over after Austin left. He didn't like Milam's move, but he gave us the support of his artillery, dropping cannonballs into an ancient, half-ruined mission which the Mexicans had long ago turned into a fort. Cottonwood stood around this once holy place, and around the high stone walls which surrounded it on all but a part of one side. Because of this, the mission had long since lost its church name and had become known by the Spanish word for cottonwood, Alamo. 6 long, hard days we fought. It was toe-to-toe battle and we moved by inches. The Mexican soldiers were tired and hungry and scared, but give them this, they fought like men. Surrounded, they could not run, so they stood and fought, and every inch of ground we gained was soaked by someone's blood. Crossing open streets was suicide. Rather than suffer terrible casualties by frontal assault, we bludgeoned our way toward the enemy's strong points by taking battering rams and plowing through the stone and adobe walls. Slowly, we made our gains. The cost was high. The third day, Ben Milam stepped out into the street and a bullet struck him in the head. He never knew what hit him. At last, we had the crumbling old Alamo itself under our guns. Our battering ram smashed through the adobe wall of a small Mexican house. Dust and gun smoke hung heavily in the air. For a second, I glimpsed brown faces and excited black eyes before the guns flashed red and bullets went whining. Then, all lay quiet. In the room, only the dust and the smoke still moved, suction drawing them out through the gaping hole. Half a dozen of us stumbled into the room, our rifles ready to fire again. Crumpled on the floor lay 5 Mexican soldiers, all of them dead but one, and he mortally wounded. I don't know what drew my gaze to the slight figure slumped in a corner. Even before I saw the face, I felt my heart skip. I dropped to one knee and gently turned the body over. I could tell at a touch that life was gone. A mass of blood had welled out of 2 holes in the front of the dirty shirt. I knew that begrimed crimson-smeared face. Felix Hernandez.
Friend of yours, Josh?
A kid is all he was. I've known him for years.
Too bad. He ought to have been on our side.
At his age, he oughtn't have been on anybody's side. I pulled at a small chain and found the crucifix Felix had been wearing around his neck. It would be the only thing of value he had on him. The family would want it for remembrance. Carefully, I removed it and put it in my pocket.
Looky yonder! Look at the Alamo! There's a white flag going up!
I stared in disbelief, but there it was, rising to the top of a pole, the breeze catching it and flapping it wildly. The gunfire slowly died away, and in its place came the wild, jubilant shouting of the Texians. 6 days of hell had ended. I slumped to the dirt floor of the little house and leaned back against the adobe wall, exhausted, numb. Within reach of me lay the body of Felix Hernandez, but I couldn't bring myself to look at him again. Why couldn't they have raised the flag an hour earlier? I stood beside Thomas as we watched General Koss march out of San Antonio on the road that led south to the interior of Mexico. With him went the remnant of his troops. In 2 weeks, there wouldn't be a hostile Mexican soldier left in Texas. I had looked up Antonio Hernandez among the prisoners after the battle. I had tried to tell him about Felix. He heard me. He had to, but he gave no sign of it. He refused to look at me, to answer me. His face was like something carved out of stone. He was with the troops as they moved south.
Thomas, it's over. I'm going home.
It ain't over, Josh. It ain't hardly even begun. They'll be back. And the next time there'll be more of them than there was before.
What do you figure on doing?
There's some of us want to go down into Mexico and carry the fight to them. Burn their town, spoil their land.
Thomas, weren't the last few days enough for you? Haven't you seen enough blood spilled to last you for a lifetime?
It's them or us, Josh. We're not half done fighting.
I've had enough. I'm going home.
I had almost rather have taken a whipping at the hands of Santa Anna himself than to have to go to the Hernandez house with the message I carried. I took Muley with me, for he had stuck to me like a burr. We rode the familiar trail, and I dreaded the first sight of that stone house. When it came in view, I could see that very little had changed in the 3 years since I had been there. I reined my horse to a stop and looked at the place a long time, trying to get my courage up. Old memories came racing through my mind. Memories I had forcibly buried a long time ago.
How come we stopped, Josh? I thought we was going in.
We're going in, Muley. It's the hardest thing I've ever had to do, but we're going in. You stay out here with the little ones, Muley. I'll go on in and do what I've got to do. I gripped the crucifix nervously in my fist and walked up under the brush arbor to the front door.
Teresa!
The girl at the door stared in surprise, then slowly shook her head.
Not Teresa. It's been a long time since we've seen each other, Josh Buckaloo. Don't you know me?
Maria?
Yes, I am Maria. I've changed since you saw me last. You've changed too, Josh.
I could tell that in some ways she looked like her sister, and in other ways she didn't. The swift first impression had brought the image of Teresa back to me. Maria was not quite so tall. She was pretty, but she didn't have quite the fragile beauty of Teresa. Maria looked stronger, surer of herself. I doubted there was anything fragile about her.
The window's sharp outside, Josh. Come into the house.
I'm sorry if I look like a fool. It's just that for a second or two, you gave me an awful start.
I would never take you for a fool, Josh. Please, come on in.
Josh Buckaloo, this is a surprise. After all these years, you finally come to see us. I thought you were off to war.
I was. Fighting is over now. I'm home again.
Is it over?
Then perhaps Antonio and Felix will be coming home.
Miranda, where's Ramon?
He rode out to find a horse. He should be home in a little while.
Please, Josh, sit down. Tell us about the fighting. Was it terrible? Were you wounded?
Yes, it was terrible. No, I was not even scratched.
And is it over now? All the men will be home?
Not all the men. At last, Ramon came. I gathered all my courage and told them about Felix and Antonio. I held out my hand with the crucifix in it.
I'm sorry. I wish there was something I could say, Ramon, besides that I'm sorry.
Thank you, Josh, for coming and telling us. Now, please, I would like you to go.
Muley and I finished the scrapping that was left on the little bit of cotton he had not already picked. Later, we planted a crop of wheat for spring harvest. It seemed there was always too much work to do. We saw nothing of Ramon Hernandez. The war news we received was scant and mostly contradictory, but rumors kept drifting in that Santa Anna was gathering an army in Saltillo. How large it would be was something we could only guess at. Many Texians were not prone to worry, for they felt sure one American could whip 10 Mexicans. After San Antonio, I didn't believe this, if I ever had. In any case, no one thought Santa Anna would start north before spring. We all figured it would be late March or even April at the earliest before his troops would wet their feet in the Rio Grande. Our Texas army was small and badly scattered, ill-disciplined and ill-equipped. Worse, its officers were quarreling among themselves. Sam Houston had the command, on paper, but not many of the subordinate officers paid much attention to him. The command was splintered. And that was the way things stood when Santa Anna's advance guard crossed the Rio Grande on the 12th of February, 6 weeks to 2 months earlier than anyone really expected. He caught us scattered, quarreling, and totally unprepared. The first word of Santa Anna's advance was brought by red-faced old Alfred Noonan. Though any Mexican pursuit had been left days behind him, Noonan spurred into our yard as if Santa Anna were reaching for his shirt tail.
Josh Buckaloo, you better go see about your brother.
I never had felt any respect for the old man, and after the Battle of San Antonio, I had only contempt.
Muley, go water Noonan's horse for him, will you?
Much obliged.
Now what's this about Thomas?
Old Santa Annie's done crossed into Texas with the biggest bunch of Mexicans that you ever saw in your whole life. He's a-coming, Josh. There ain't nothing going to stop him but the good Lord himself. And the way things are going, he must be busy someplace else.
What about Thomas?
Boy, I'm afeard your brother's wounded. Maybe dead. There was a scrap down on the Rio Grande. A little bunch of our boys got caught by them Mexicans. It was like a panther pouncing on a mouse. Most of our boys got themselves killed. Thomas was with that bunch.
You're sure, Noonan? You're not just scared and excited?
He was down there, him and the Phipps boys and some others, was all fixing to go and raid Matamoros. But the orders never did come through, so they stayed down there and watched along the river. I was supposed to have been with them, but only something else come up. Jacob Phipps come back, shot in the arm. He said he seen his brother Ezekiel get his head blowed off. The last he seen of Thomas, he was riding off into the dust and the smoke to where the big shooting was. There was an awful scatteration after that. A few of the boys like Jacob come limping back. Most of the others never did. Far as I know, Thomas didn't.
As far as you know? Didn't you try to find out?
Boy, them Mexicans was a-coming. I'm telling you, they wasn't like any Mexicans I ever saw. They was thousands of them, and they was looking for blood.
If Thomas did come back, Noonan, where would he most likely be?
Hard to say. Maybe Bar, where Travis and Bowie are at. Maybe Goliad, because Fannin was there, and we were sort of under Fannin's command there towards the last.
You want to go back and help me look for him?
No, thank you. I had enough Mexicans to do me for the rest of my life. I'm taking the Sabine Chute.
You got a farm here.
Old Sammy Annie can just have it back.
I was too numb to offer him anything to eat, and he was in too much of a hurry to have accepted it. Soon as Muley brought his horse back, Noonan spurred away. I leaned my shoulder against the log cabin and stood there weakly, watching him disappear over the hill. Muley, I gotta leave you again.
No, Josh, please. You just got back. Don't leave me alone here again.
Muley, you listen to me and listen tight. There's no telling when I may get back. If the Mexicans come, and they may, don't let yourself get caught by them. You run. Take the best horse we got and run just as fast as you can. If you have to cross the Sabine, you do it, and don't stop to look back. When this is all over, I'll come find you.
Josh, I don't know what I'd do if you was not to come back.
I'll come back, Muley. You just wait here at the farm.
You promise, Josh. You promise you come back.
I promise, Muley. Now you take good care of things while I'm gone. And remember what I said. Watch sharp. Don't let the Mexicans find you here.
It was now past the middle of February. Riding for San Antonio de Bar, I found people still not certain what to do. Some were packing their belongings and getting ready to head east. A few were already on the road. But most were waiting, still hopeful that the Texian forces could turn back the assault. I rode into Bar a little less than 3 months after I had left it. The city still showed all the scars of the awful battle. Many of the stone and adobe houses caved in, gaping holes knocked in their sides by cannonballs or battering rams. I rode up to the high old stone walls of the Alamo and found them fortified. If it came to the point of making a stand, I thought Travis would probably pull his men into the mission.
Howdy, Josh. You come to help us fight Santa Ana?
Jared, you're looking good. To me, you always look good.
And I look better than I feel. I reckon you know what's coming, Josh.
I've heard rumors, all of them bad. Jared, is Thomas here?
No, is he supposed to be?
I got word he was in some fighting on the Rio Grande near Matamoros. That's the last place anyone saw him.
Josh, I think you better make up your mind to accept it. Thomas is likely dead.
There's still the shadow of a doubt, Jared. I can't stop looking till I know for sure.
I was hoping you'd stay here with us. We'll be needing all the men we can get.
Short way along the wall, I watched Travis supervising the building of an embankment for emplacement of a cannon. The strain of command had left its mark. He was impatient and snappish with the men doing the work.
Oh, he's trying, but he's fussing with the wrong men. The ones he needs to crack the whip over are out in town enjoying themselves. Seems like the men are ready to fight and die with him, but they ain't willing to follow his orders.
Across the courtyard came Big Jim Bowie, walking unsteadily.
He's been drinking a little, but mostly he's just sick, needs to be in bed. He and Travis don't get along, but they have to put up with each other. Half these men here won't listen to anybody except Bowie.
Travis and Bowie's quarreling would soon end, for the enemy was almost at the gates. Then they would stand together, shoulder to shoulder, and leave the world a legend that would never die.
I wish you were staying.
I can't. I expect I'll go next to Goliad. Thomas could be there.
If you don't find him, come back. The Alamo walls are high and stout.
None of us had a premonition then of what would so shortly come to pass. I did remember, though, that one reason General Koss had surrendered his Mexican troops to us in December
was that he considered the Alamo indefensible. Even now, most of the old Texians were not thinking in terms of independence. They were thinking only of defeating the despot Santa Anna and getting a fair shake from the Mexican government.
Josh, I've been doing a lot of thinking lately about what I'm going to do when the fighting's over. You remember it was me that showed you the place that you boys settled.
I remember.
There's still some land close by open for settlement. I think when we get the shooting finished and square ourselves with Mexico, I'll take up some land out there and be neighbors with you. I always did like that country along the Colorado.
We'll look forward to it, Jared. I glanced back once as I rode away and caught a last look at the lean old man there by the front of the Alamo. I would never forget it. The road from San Antonio to Goliad roughly paralleled the San Antonio River. I set out from the city without delay, for I had a strong feeling there wasn't much time. And there wasn't. I knew I'd have to do a lot of hard riding and very little resting until I reached Goliad. I learned something else, too. The lesson was abrupt and unexpected. I rode up to a Mexican house expecting to ask for a fresh drink of water. What I got was a blast from an old escopeta in the hands of a Mexican farmer. He missed me, but he taught me that from now on I had to avoid habitations. A good percentage of the Mexican people in Texas disliked Santa Anna, but he had proclaimed this a holy war, Mexican against American. It was, he said, a racial war, dark skins against the light. Now that Mexican troops were in the country again, I could not afford to trust any Mexican, civilian or soldier. From this point on, I moved carefully, leaving the road and skirting any houses I came to. The old Presidio at Bahia, generally known as Goliad by the time of the Texas Revolution, had changed hands often, usually with violence. Now it was probably the chief Texian stronghold, for James W. Fannin had between 400 and 500 volunteers quartered there. Built on a solid rock atop a hill stood the Presidio itself, its thick stone and lime walls weathered to an oppressive gray by the long years. This was the finest fort the Spaniards had ever built in Texas, for it straddled an important road from Nacogdoches to the interior of Mexico, and it was also near the sea. Soldiers stood along the walls and out in front. Riding into the fort, I was struck by the fact that most of these men were not actually Texians. A majority were volunteers fresh in from various southern states. Something else struck me too. The strong faith in these men that they could whip anything that came along.
Bring any Mexicans with you? We're ready for a fight.
I explained my mission and was taken directly to Colonel Fannin. He didn't give me time at first to ask about Thomas. He insisted on hearing how things stood in San Antonio and back in the settlements. I told him San Antonio had still been open when I had left there. He paced, his hands behind him.
You saw no soldiers. You saw no columns.
All I can tell you is the rumors I've heard. You've likely heard those already.
100 rumors and no two alike. We don't know what's going on in the south. For that matter, we know very little what's going on to the north and east. We're isolated. Sometimes I think they've all forgotten us.
I doubt that so, sir. One story I've heard is that a lot of men are gathering in Gonzales, building up an army. I expect General Houston will take command of them if it's true, and they'll most likely be marching in this direction.
I hope so. Meanwhile, I wish they'd let me know what's going on. I wish I could tell just what to do.
It looks to me like this fort's situated to stand off a big siege.
Yeah, well, you know how Mexicans fight. It'll take a lot of them to dislodge us. We'll never give up the ship while there's a pea left in the dish.
Colonel, I've come looking for my brother, Thomas Buckaloo. A man named Noonan told me he saw my brother during some fighting on the Rio Grande near Matamoros. I wondered if Thomas might be here. Fannin went to his duty rosters and slowly ran his fingers down the pages, shaking his head as he came to the bottom of each one.
No, I'm sorry. There doesn't seem to be a Buckaloo listed here anywhere.
Colonel, does what Noonan said sound like anything you've heard of? Do you know of any scrap that fits the description?
Our reports from down that way have been very sketchy, Buckaloo. And there could have been a dozen engagements, and we wouldn't have heard of them. Now, it's possible that your brother could be attached to Johnson's force at San Patricio. If you're going that way, I hope you find him alive. And Buckaloo, if you find out what the Mexicans are up to, find a way to get the information to me.
I'll do what I can, sir. It was all strange country to me, but I wasn't interested in seeing the country. My immediate concern was to get to San Patricio without falling into Mexican hands. I followed the trail, or without it, I wouldn't know the way. But as on the road to Goliad, I took pains to skirt around any Mexican dwellings. I came at last to a house that was plainly American built. Here, at least, I would be welcome. I rode up to it boldly. That turned out to be a grievous mistake. A Mexican civilian stepped into the yard, a blunderbuss in his hand, and fired at me without so much as a howdy-do. That was my second such experience. Santa Ana's race war idea had taken hold. I knew now I would have to live by Thomas's old credo, never trust a Mexican. The rations I'd carried with me from Goliad gave out, and I ate dry bread until I came across a fat cow, caught and butchered her. Taking some of a hind quarter, I rode a long way before daring to stop and cook the meat. I'd lost count of time, but I knew it was the last of February or first of March when I ran into the three stragglers. They could have been Mexicans for all I knew. I drew off the trail and into a clump of timber, covering my horse's nose with my hand, hoping they hadn't seen me. My rifle was cradled in my arm, ready. The horseman came directly toward me, one slumped forward, another helping hold him in the saddle. Their horses sensed mine. Instantly, two of the men slid off onto the ground, thrusting their rifle barrels up over their saddles. They could have been either Mexican or American. I held my breath and brought my rifle to rest across the branch of a tree, my hand tightened on the stock.
Grab Bill, he's falling off.
It's all right, I'm a Texian.
They still didn't trust me. I led my horse out of the timber and dropped the rifle down to arm's length to show I wasn't hostile. The two men on their feet still kept their rifles pointed at me. I saw that one, a man with red hair and a tangled red beard, was holding his leg out stiffly. A dried crimson spot showed on the dirty cloth wrapped around the leg. The wounded man in the saddle had a gray coat bundled around him, one sleeve dangling empty. Bloodstains showed he had been shot deep in the shoulder.
It's all right, I come from Goliad.
Lord, it's sure good to see a friendly face. I hope to God you got something with you a man could eat, and maybe a little water. Bill here is burning up with fever.
I helped him lower the wounded man to the grass and brought my canteen. While I carefully doled out water to the one named Bill, the other two hungrily tore into what was left of the beef.
It's been much hiding and little water. No rations for us since them Mexicans hit us at San Patricio.
San Patricio?
They came on us unexpectedly, killed nearly every man. I never thought there was so many Mexicans.
I was on my way to San Patricio, looking for my brother.
Mister, if he was there, I expect he's dead.
His name is Thomas Buckaloo. Do you know him?
Buckaloo. I don't believe I recollect such a name as that. There wasn't no Buckaloo at San Patricio, was there, Red?
Buckaloo. I seem to remember there was a Buckaloo, but not at San Patricio. He was south with a patrol that worked down all the way to the Rio Grande.
Where would he be now?
In heaven, I expect. Or in hell. Most of the boys down on the river were killed by the first Mexicans that crossed over.
Did you see anybody who said they saw him die?
No, but there was only a handful came out alive.
He could be down there someplace hiding out, maybe wounded. I might be able to find him.
Well, you'd be throwing your life away to try. You know that country down there? Ever been there before?
No.
Well, there's nothing down there now but Mexicans, thousands of them. They caught even the boys that knew the country. You'd go down like a rabbit in a wolf's den.
I seen one boy that lost his horse throw his hands up and try to surrender. They shot him to pieces.
And that's why you gotta go back with us. You got no chance at all. Besides, we need help with Bill.
My jaw went tight when I looked down at the worst wounded of the three. He wouldn't live to reach Goliad. That bullet had been in him too deep and too long. So when all the talking was done, I had to turn my back on Thomas and San Patricio. I had to accept the probability that Thomas had fallen with the others, and that even if he hadn't, there was nothing I could do for him. Only three of us lasted to reach Goliad. We scratched out a shallow grave for Bill and left him near Blanco Creek. We led his horse on in. At a time like this, horses would be worth more than gold. Nobody paid much attention to me. Hardly anyone in the fort at Goliad knew me anyway. Most of them hadn't been in Texas more than a few weeks. There were volunteers from the States, for the most part, come to whip the breeches off a bunch of dirty Mexicans. Besides, I hadn't been in any of the recent fighting. But the men thronged around Red and Jimson, eager for details of the battle.
What's the battle news?
Battle, hell. It wasn't no battle. It was a slaughter.
Gentlemen, do you have news? Aren't you the man that was here looking for his brother?
I haven't found him. I didn't get to San Patricio.
I'm sorry. Now, I've already had the bad news from San Patricio, but I'd like to hear it from your viewpoint.
They gave it to him briefly and simply. Fannin questioned them closely about the Mexican strength. They could only guess, for their knowledge of the war was limited to what went on in front of them. The war, to them, was whatever their own part of the battle had meant. And for Red and Jimson, it had been bitter.
Well, there weren't enough of you, and you had no position of strength. So the Mexicans took you. Well, here we have one of the best fortifications in Texas, and adequate men to defend it. When they get here, we'll stop them cold. I can use you men, all three of you, if you'd care to stay.
I'm tired of riding with this. I'd sure admire to rest, and I doubt there's a safer place anywhere than Goliad.
I'll take up where my brother left off. And here is as good a place as any to turn and fight.
I'll stay and fight, right here with you boys.
So, without ceremony, we were marched into Fannin's command of volunteers inside that gray grimstone fortress on the hill. I was at the gate the day a courier came downriver from the direction of San Antonio and spurred up the hill on a worn-out horse. Stiff and weary, he almost fell from his mount as he reined to a stop. I helped grab him.
Colonel Fannin. Message for Colonel Fannin.
We'll take you to him. Where'd you come from?
From San Antonio de Bar. The Mexicans have gotten there.
How bad is it?
Bad. Travis, Bowie, and the others, they forded up in the old Alamo. Travis sent me to fetch help.
We took him to Fannin's quarters. The courier braced with a strong shot of whiskey while Fannin read the message from Travis, his brow furrowed.
My last orders were to hold Goliad. If I split my force and go to Bar, I would jeopardize our position here.
They're gonna need help if they hope to hold the Alamo.
90 miles to San Antonio! Even with a forced march, it would take us time to get there if we took the equipment we need. I wish to God I knew what to do.
Later, Fannin made his decision. Against his better judgment, he ordered us to prepare for a forced march to the relief of the Bar garrison. We hadn't gotten far before we had a breakdown. Somewhere to the south, and probably not far, was a strong Mexican force. Fannin reversed his decision. The order came to retreat to Goliad. It was a foregone conclusion now that the Alamo would not stand. Better to stay together and hold Goliad than to risk the loss of all. The courier, disregarding the admonitions of all around him, spurred once again toward San Antonio to carry the bad news to Travis. Fannin wasn't coming. He could have stayed. To return to the Alamo was death, and he knew it, but he went. It was a cold, grim day when the expected news came from San Antonio. The Alamo had been overwhelmed. The garrison had been slaughtered to the last man. Yet the strange thing was that few really thought it could happen to us. Not here at Goliad. When Mexicans came, we'd show them how Americans could fight. We'd repay them for the Alamo. What began to break our back was the division of our forces. Word came from the village of Refugio, some 30 miles east toward the Gulf, that families there wanted to leave and needed an escort. Fannin sent Captain King of the Georgia Battalion and a company of 23 men. Reaching Refugio, they found themselves hard-pressed by Mexican cavalry. They took cover in an old mission. A messenger managed to break through the Mexican lines and reach Goliad. This time, Fannin sent out Colonel Ward with the Georgia Battalion of about 150 men to relieve King. We didn't know it then, but these men would never come back. We expected their return at almost any time, but a day passed, 2 days, and still no word. Then came a courier from Sam Houston, bearing orders to Fannin that we abandon Goliad and retreat to Victoria, to the area of heavier American settlement. Had we followed the orders when they arrived, things might have turned out differently. But Ward and King were still out. We couldn't just abandon them. Fannin was between a rock and a hard place, between military obligation to his commanding officer and the moral obligation he felt toward the men he had sent out and had not heard from. So again, we waited. 1 day, 2 days, 3 days. The Mexicans weren't waiting. At last, Fannin found out for certain what we had all begun to feel in our bones. Ward and King and their commands had been taken. With daylight, we set forth into heavy fog on the road to Victoria. Because I had a horse, I was attached to Colonel Horton's scouts. We rode ahead to the ford on the San Antonio River, half expecting attack there, for we had seen Mexicans. The attack didn't come, but the largest cannon stuck in the river. We lost an hour pulling it out of the mud. In all the bustle, nobody had thought to feed the oxen. They were hungry and contrary. All in all, it started out to be a hard day. We were well across the prairie, about 10 miles from Goliad, and the oxen were still giving trouble. Ahead of us lay Calado Creek and a heavy stand of timber, but we came across a patch of new grass in an area that had been burned over by the prairie fire. Fannin decided we had better rest and graze the oxen, or they might never get us to the timber. So another order went down the line, stop and unyoke. I didn't like it, but nobody asked me. Somewhere, not far away, there had to be a large force of Mexicans. Our scouting group went out to look around while the command rested. We didn't go far and we didn't see anything. When we returned, the oxen were yoked again and the march resumed. We could camp when we reached the timber, the officers agreed. We never made it. A vague, dark line began moving up in timber to the south of us. As it detached itself from the timber, we saw that the line was made of horsemen, and many of them. We looked back. Behind us came another line. Both lines approached rapidly and began spreading out.
My God, there are thousands of them.
There weren't, but there were enough to take a man's breath away. We began crowding the oxen, struggling to make the timber. One of the six-pounders was quickly unlimbered. A shot was fired at the horseman, and another. But all three rounds fell short. The Mexicans kept coming. Our rear guard came galloping up. We pushed on a little farther. The ammunition car broke down. We lost time while men transferred the load. By then, the Mexican cavalrymen had circled around to the front of us. They'd cut us off from the timber.
Circle up, men! Circle up!
Some of the volunteers began firing their rifles, but the range was still much too long. We formed a hollow square facing our artillery outward to fire on the enemy from whatever direction they might come. Now we could make out the horsemen distinctly. We could see the flying pennants. The Mexican cavalry spurred toward us from three directions. Our artillery opened up with grape and canister shot. We could see horses and men go down. The Mexicans kept coming right into the range of our rifles and muskets. We began to fire, timing ourselves by rank so that one group was in position to shoot while another was loading. Great gaps were blasted through the Mexican ranks. Still, on they came. Their forward riders were upon the square itself when the rapid and deadly fire of our volunteers stopped them. The Mexicans reeled back, loose horses running wild, stirrups flapping. While the Mexicans pulled back, we reloaded and surveyed our own damage. It was heavy. We had already lost most of our horses and oxen. We had several men killed and a number wounded. To my dismay, I found that Red lay lifeless behind one of the cannons, a gaping hole in his chest. He had taken a bullet through the leg at San Patricio, but had survived to rejoice that Goliad would be safe for him. Now he was dead. The irony of it was bitter. Before this was over, he would turn out to be the lucky one. The fire continued until nightfall. Then the enemy withdrew to the timber. That gave us time to look around and consider our situation. The longer we looked, the less we liked it. Ahead of us, so near and yet so far away, stood the timber we had been trying for. Once in it, we could take advantage of its cover and stand off a force several times our size. Out here in this open prairie, we were paralyzed. But how could we ever reach the timber now? In the growing darkness, we could see the wink of Mexican campfires around us. Our teams were gone, either stampeded by the gunfire or killed by it. We had 7 men dead, 60 wounded. The majority of these wounded would be unable to walk. Among the wounded was Fannin himself. He had taken a rifle ball in the thigh. What water we had with us was gone. Most of the ammunition for our cannons was used up. Food supplies were scanty, for the officers had felt confident we would reach Victoria and had not wanted to overload the wagons. Now night fell upon us, cold and terribly dark. I still had my blanket, but I found that many of the men had dropped theirs when the fighting started. Now they were without. I tucked my blanket around a wounded man who lay shivering from the cold. He cried for water, but I had none.
We still have a chance to reach Coleto Creek and the timber. The darkness will help cover us. And I think if we run into Mexican troops, we can fight our way through. But we'll have to go afoot, and there are many among our wounded who cannot walk. We can go, and we can reach safety. But if we go, we'll have to leave those who cannot make the journey afoot.
Colonel, what will the Mexicans do with the men we leave?
You all heard that report that came to us about the few of Captain King's men who surrendered at Refugio. They were taken out and shot.
Well, that means they'll probably shoot anybody we leave behind.
Very well. We'll stay. We'll build whatever fortifications we can during the night, and we'll see what the morning will bring.
The night was long and black and cold. The little bit of water had long since been used up. All of us thirsted, but for the injured, the night was torture. A light mist hung in the air, though not enough to afford relief. On the contrary, it made the cold bite deeper. Hungry, cold, sleepless, those of us who were able worked through the night digging trenches, fortifying ourselves the best we could. It was too cold to rest long at a time. Instead, we worked. When we had the ditches 2 or 3 feet deep, we dragged up the ox carts and the carcasses of horses and oxen and placed them for breastworks. Daylight finally came. We could see the Mexicans moving. We threw ourselves face down into the tramped out grass and dirt. The shots were too high. They were over our heads.
Don't fire back! The range is too great! And our ammunition is too low. Let's wait until we can hit what we shoot at!
Not a single shot hit inside our tight square. Again, movement started among the ranks of the Mexican cavalry. We brought up our rifles and muskets, sure the charge was about to commence. Instead, an officer rode out carrying a white flag.
Maybe they want to give up.
One of our majors and some other officers walked out to meet the Mexican about halfway between our position and the enemy lines. They talked a little, then came back. The major went straight to Fannin.
That's General Urrea's command out there. The general sends word that he wants to avoid shedding blood without reason. He guarantees it will be dealt with leniently if we surrender at discretion.
At discretion? That means unconditional surrender! And that means we retain no rights! We turn ourselves over to them to be treated in any way they see fit!
I reckon that's what it means.
You go back and you tell him we shall not surrender at discretion. We had rather die to the last man in these trenches!
The major delivered his message. The Mexican officer wheeled his horse around and carried the report to General Urrea. Shortly, the whole Mexican line began to move again. It looked once more as if the charge would start at any moment. Instead, a handful of men rode out toward the truce area.
Look at the uniform on that Mexican. That must be Urrea.
It is Urrea indeed. He wants to parley. Well, I guess this time I'd better go. Men, I suspect that this time he has a better offer or he wouldn't have come. I know as commander I am supposed to make these decisions, but this may mean your lives, and I'll not make the decision alone. Now, if you choose, we'll stay here and fight until we die. But if you vote to surrender, and we are offered acceptable terms, I shall abide by your vote. What say you?
Either way, we lose. We're trapped here. If we stay, we'll either starve or be killed. We can't break out without leaving the wounded, and the longer we stay, the more wounded there'll be.
We couldn't leave the wounded, so it comes to this. We stay here and die for certain or surrender in hope.
You know what happened to King's and Ward's men who surrendered? They were shot.
A chance of war. If it was an easy decision, we wouldn't be standing here arguing over it.
In the end, the decision was made. We would surrender if Fannin could get us good terms. Otherwise, we would stay here and die like the men of the Alamo had died. Fannin went out, the major and some of the other officers with him. Every step he took was agony. After a long time, Fannin and the Major came back. And with them came the resplendent General Urrea himself, bringing several aides. They wrote down the agreement, a copy in Spanish and one in English. All signed it. Fannin folded the English copy and put it inside his coat. So we gave up our arms and marched out of the trenches, carrying our wounded with us. It was a slow, painful, pride-killing return to the fortress we had left. Nobody talked much, for the shock and hurt went too deep. Most of these men had come to Texas lightheartedly looking for the grand adventure, the great crusade, to strike a blow for liberty and show a contemptible enemy how Americans could fight. It was all for nothing. They could fight, these volunteers, but they had been wasted by poor planning and indecision and a fatal contempt for the enemy. They put us in what had once been the chapel, and we began to wish we hadn't worked so hard to destroy everything in the fortress before we left it. That first night was torture. We were crowded so tightly that not all had room to lie down. The trapped air was hot and stifling. The wounded suffered severely for want of attention. The Mexicans had taken our few doctors away to treat their own men. Gangrene developed in some of the wounds. The stench and the moaning of the men made cold sweat break out on the rest of us. We had water now, for details were permitted to go down under guard and fetch it from the river. But there was little food and no chance to make broth for the men who so badly needed it. Some of our wounded passed away, and death came to them as a friend. It was the following Friday that a call went up.
More prisoners!
The gates opened. More than 100 men dragged in. I couldn't say they marched, and the gates closed behind them. Among the new prisoners was Major Ward, and the tiny remnant of his men who had survived the Battle of Refugio. In addition, there were 100 or so fresh volunteers, taken at Capano the minute they stepped down from their ship. They never had a chance to take a rifle in hand, much less to fire it. I couldn't bring myself to look at them. I dropped my gaze, staring at my dirt-crusted moccasins, my ragged breeches.
Josh! Thomas!
I jumped to my feet and grabbed him. We hugged each other, blubbering like children. At last, he groaned, and I saw what I had overlooked in my haste and my joy. He was wounded. His tattered coat was buttoned with his left arm inside, the sleeve hanging empty.
Thomas, I thought you were dead.
I thought for a while that I was, too. Damn it, Josh, I hate to be finding you here.
I'm glad to find you here, or any place. I'd given you up.
You shouldn't have gotten yourself into this. You ought to have stayed home.
Old Noonan came by the place. Said he thought you'd been wounded or killed. I set out to find you.
Noonan, that old scoundrel. Big talk, but a yellow streak as wide as your hat. Time for fighting come around, he wasn't to be seen. I'm sure sorry to find you here.
Where were you? How bad is that wound?
I was south of San Patricio on patrol. The Mexicans caught me by surprise, killed most of the boys. They shot me in the shoulder and killed my horse. He fell on top of me. They left me there for dead. I finally got out from under the horse and started walking north. It was mighty slow going. Josh, I sure hope you got something here to eat. I'm starved.
There's not much. We've all been hungry for days. A few of the boys managed to hide away a little coin when the soldiers looted us. They've been buying a small bit of bread and coffee from the camp followers. Outside of that, the Mexicans have been bringing us a little beef. Nothing more. Thomas, you'd better let me look at that shoulder.
Yeah, the bullet's out. Time will take care of the rest of it. If we got any time.
What do you mean? We have a guarantee from Urrea. Colonel Fannin has a copy of the agreement in his pocket.
Where is Urrea now?
He left. Went on to wherever the fighting is. A colonel by the name of Portilla is in charge now.
Urrea signed the paper and now he's gone?
Thomas started asking me how things had been at home when I left. I told him all I could. It was strange how all our past differences faded away under these cruel gray walls. Whatever bitterness might have lingered in me had disappeared in my relief at seeing him. The trouble we shared now, the oppression of captivity, made us brothers again. Thomas told me how he had wandered afoot after the battle, the wound causing a fever that set him to staggering half out of his head. An old Mexican found him, took pity on him, and carried him to his jacal. There the old man and his wife dug the bullet out of him. They hid him for days while Mexican patrols scouted for stragglers.
Josh, I always said I'd never take a favor off a Mexican. That pair saved my life. I owe them more than I could ever say. If I get out of this alive, I'll find some way to pay them. If I don't get out and you do, I want you to pay them for me.
Thomas, you'll get out. The war is over for us. They say they're going to send us home.
Maybe. But if I don't make it, find Mr. and Mrs. Sanchez. You remember now. I'm wanting to see that those old folks don't ever need for nothing.
Sure, Thomas, if it comes to that. But we're both going to live. If the Mexicans take Texas away from us, we can always go home to Tennessee, and we'll go together.
Palm Sunday, March 27th, was a beautiful morning, bright and shining with the hope of freedom. Some of the friendlier guards had brought us the rumor that a ship was being sent to Capano to take us on board and carry us to the United States. A feeling of vast relief had swept gloom from the prisoners' compound. Now there was rising jubilation.
Home! They're sending us home!
Last night we had all sung Home Sweet Home, and the words brought tears that burned many an eye. We didn't know that as we sang, a courier arrived from Santa Ana. The general had flown into a black rage when he learned about Uriah's prisoners, so the courier had brought Colonel Portilla a written order that the officer crumpled in horror. We didn't know the colonel had paced in his quarters all night, racked by conscience, praying for forgiveness for what he had to do. The gates opened. We stood up, those who could, hoping the guards had brought beef. Instead, a Mexican officer stepped into the yard and signaled for us to gather around.
Good news, my friends. You are starting home today. The ship is arriving in Copano. You have but to walk there. Those who are able to walk will do so. The badly wounded will stay. They will be taken later in carts. It will be necessary for guard purposes to divide you into groups.
He picked out our officers and told them to gather us into their own commands. Because Thomas had been captured alone and belonged to no group here, I kept him with me. I saw hope flicker in his eyes, but I saw doubt there too. I saw Fannin lying on the ground, unable to walk except with the greatest pain and difficulty. He was smiling as he watched us. The Mexicans up to now had not honored all the terms of the capitulation. They'd allowed their soldiers to rob us. They'd not fed us as they had agreed. But now they were sending us home.
Thomas, you better stay here. Let them bring you in a cart.
I'll make it. I want to get out into the clear air.
We were marched out the gate, one group at a time. Ours was the third to leave. The last, the men with the white armbands, were still inside. They started us down toward the old fort on the river. Thomas kept looking back over his shoulder.
Funny thing, Josh. They didn't bring the other two bunches this way.
What do you mean?
Well, they took them off in other directions. This is the road to Copano.
I didn't have an answer. I looked at the armed Mexican guards who marched on both sides of our strung-out line, an uneasiness stirring in me. About 100 volunteers were in our group. The other groups, which had gone out before us, had been much the same. There weren't as many of the guards as there were of us. That didn't look like treachery. And yet, Thomas's contagious suspicion began to work on me. Several Mexican cavalrymen leisurely worked their way down on horseback from their encampment, carrying lances under their arms.
They must be figuring on prodding up the slow ones. We're going home, there ain't nobody apt to be very slow.
I kept watching Thomas now, and I saw his suspicion gradually change into alarm. He turned now and again, counting the guards over and over, seeing where they were. His restless eyes followed the lancers.
Josh, if worst comes to worst, the lancers are the ones you gotta watch. Half of these guards probably can't shoot, but those lancers will sure run you through.
Thomas, you're just borrowing trouble.
I'm talking, that's all. But you listen, and listen good. There's lots of brush along the river. A man could hide himself in there if he ever made it that far. With luck, he could hold out till dark. Then he could head out across the country. He'd have a chance to get back to our own lines and maybe strike another blow at Santa Ana.
You ought to have stayed and ridden in the cart like I told you. You're not walking too good. Your shoulder paining you much?
If we're really going to Copano, I'll make it. If we're going to die, I'll die out here where the air is clean.
Thomas, you quit talking about dying.
You remember what I said about that old Mexican couple? You see after him, you hear?
I wondered how he figured if something was going to happen, that I would live through it and he wouldn't. I guess he knew that with his bad shoulder, he couldn't run far.
Alto!
Tell him we're not tired yet. Tell him we want to keep on walking.
The
The squad of guards on the upriver side of us began to move. They split, half going around in front of us, half in back of us. In a moment, they filed up to join the guards who were stationed between us and the river. Thomas tensed. I saw his face turn a leaden gray.
My God, boys. They're gonna kill us.
Wrestling, boys! It's our only chance!
The river, Josh! The river!
Some of the men began to run toward the Mexicans, hoping to overwhelm them. The soldiers raised rifles to their shoulders. I stood paralyzed, my mouth dry, the cold hand of death holding me there in horror. I looked down the barrel of the rifle that was going to kill me. Thomas moved suddenly. He stepped directly in front of me. The impact slammed Thomas's body back against me. Men fell like wheat beneath a scythe. I clutched Thomas, but my hand was sticky and warm. I knew instinctively that he was already dead. For a moment I lay there, half pinned down by his weight, numb, unable to move, to think, to speak. Then the realization came to me that I was still alive. I hadn't even been hit. Thomas had taken the bullet that would have been mine. And it came to me that men who had been missed by the volley were beginning to run. There had not been enough rifles to kill us all with the first shots. More by instinct than by a conscious will, I lay still. I lay there and looked into Jimson's open, dead eyes. The Mexicans were reloading their rifles as rapidly as they could. In pursuit of those men who ran up the hill, they moved over us and away. This was my chance, if I had one at all. Stealthily, I eased out from under Thomas's weight. I gripped his hand, saying a silent goodbye. Then I jumped to my feet and sprinted toward the river. I cut sharply to the left and ran even faster. I glanced back over my shoulder, half expecting to see a mounted lancer bearing down on me. I was lucky. They were all busy elsewhere. But I saw a rifleman drawing a bead. I cut to the right. Then there was the brush. I plunged into a thicket, the branches and the thorns clutching at my ragged clothes, ripping into my skin. The horseman came loping toward me, his lance tipped forward. I would make it tough for him, catching me in this brush. Something struck my left arm. It felt like a red-hot poker. I reached up with my right hand and touched the arm and felt the thin flow of blood. I had been nicked by a rifle ball, but I kept on running. I pushed through the brush until I reached the steep riverbank. They were still coming behind me. I dived. The icy cold water paralyzed me a moment. Then I started to swim. My first thought was to try to make the opposite bank, climb out and keep running. But the current was swift. I let it carry me along and only treaded to keep my head above water. I kept trying to look back to see if I was being followed. As far as I could tell, I wasn't. In a few minutes, the current carried me to a spot where the opposite bank was not steep, and where a growth of old grass would hide whatever marks I might make as I climbed out. I clambered over the bank as quickly as I could and tried to lose myself in the timber. I dropped down on hands and knees in a heavy growth of underbrush, clutching my arm, feeling the warm trickle of blood. I could hear firing across the river as the Mexicans found and murdered one after another the unfortunate volunteers. The terror of it swept over me in a spasm of shuddering. Unable to control myself, I lay flat on the ground, clenched my fists, and let the bitter tears flow. When I was able to collect my wits, I realized I was alive, but a long way from being free. It was still less than a mile back to the fortress, with many open stretches of prairie to cross whenever I tried to move farther away. They were coming toward me. 30 yards away, a young volunteer was pounding through the brush as hard as he could. The lancers came yelping eagerly behind him like hunters after a fox.
God, no!
First lance impaled him. A second caught him and drove his body to the ground. One of the soldiers got down, put his foot on the body, and pulled the lances free. Another soldier dismounted. Together, they stripped the dead man of his clothes, laughing as if this were a sporting event and they had just killed a deer. The wounded. They were killing the wounded. Fannin and the rest. More than 300 helpless men slaughtered like cattle. I had not had time to feel anger. There had been only fear and horror. Now came the anger, a bitter, drive, and helpless rage. I pounded my fists against the ground. I knew now that I had to get out of there. Thomas, someday, somewhere, somehow, there'll come a day of reckoning for this, and I vow to you and Almighty God I'll be there. Soaking wet, hungry, bitterly cold, I huddled in the brush all that day. Now and again, patrols passed through the timber, hunting for stragglers. I stayed low. My arm stiffened and burned, but at least it was no more than a deep scratch. The ball had taken a bite of flesh and passed on. I would live. Or at least, it wouldn't be this wound that killed me. I had no hat, no coat, only these ragged clothes between me and total nakedness. With the chill of winter's breath still lingering into spring, my moccasins were thin. They probably wouldn't survive a long walk home, or even farther if the Texian line had retreated beyond it. I knew that without food, I would never get far. I'd nearly starved for a week now on the meager ration they gave us in the compound, and today there'd been nothing at all. I wondered about the deserted Mexican jacales in the town of Goliad. I might find something there if I had the nerve to go and look. A coat, a blanket, something. Maybe if I could get to one of the ranchos, I could steal some food and some clothing. I'd never stolen anything in my life. Now I was going to try without the slightest twinge of conscience. What did it matter? They were just Mexicans, I told myself. I realized I was thinking the way Thomas had always thought. Well, he was dead now, and the Mexicans had killed him. Maybe he had been right all the time, and I had been wrong. I knew from description where the ranchos lay. My clothes had fairly well dried out through the day. Still, I was chilled to the bone. Even walking, I couldn't get warm. So most of the time, I kept going, but the cold hurt me worse than being tired. I had no firm plan other than to try to sneak into a house and get some clothes to wear, some food to take along. Ahead lay a small rock house, very much like the one the Hernandez family lived in. Around it were scattered several brush jacales. A lingering smell of wood smoke touched my nostrils. My stomach growled, for wood smoke meant food. Dogs were one thing I hadn't counted on. Never occurred to me they would pick me up so quickly. I crouched behind a bush and tossed rocks at them, trying to scare them away. They didn't scare. Presently, a man appeared in the doorway, an ancient musket in his hand. I backed away in the darkness without his seeing me. I couldn't go up against that musket. Maybe there would be another house, one without dogs. A mile farther on, I saw it. I moved in slowly, expecting the same reception. But this house was quiet. No dogs. I approached stealthily, flattening myself against the rock wall. I eased myself up to the open window and listened. Inside, a man was snoring. Something moved beside me. My heart flipped. I jumped a couple of feet, whirling to face whatever it was. In a square crate made of green willow branches, I saw a rooster, one of the fighting breeds so beloved by the Mexicans. I disturbed his rest. I swallowed hard, regaining control of myself. The door was closed, but it moved easily on its leather hinges when I lifted it slightly and pushed. I opened it only enough to give me entrance, but I didn't rush anything. I stood outside and listened. On the ground, I saw a long chunk of firewood and picked it up. Flattening myself against the door jamb, I slid through the open door and raised the club, ready to strike against anything that moved. Nothing did. Slowly, I lowered the club, though I kept a tight grip on it. I looked around the tiny one-room casa a full minute, getting my bearings. I could see two people sleeping on a cowhide bed, a slightly built man and a rather stout woman. They had a couple of blankets wrapped around themselves. How I wanted one of those blankets. But any kind of clothes would be an improvement. I saw the Mexican shirt and trousers and a ragged old coat hanging from a peg. Carefully, I reached for them, took what I thought was a firm hold, and lifted.
¿Qué es? ¿Qué es?
The Mexican jumped out of bed and rushed me. I had no choice but to use that chunk of firewood. It flattened him.
¡Americano!
Before I could move, she had yanked the door open and was running out into the night.
¡Americano!
On the floor, the man swayed to his hands and knees. I looked around desperately for a gun, any kind of gun. There wasn't any. The man was pushing himself to his feet. Out in the darkness, the woman was running for help. In a minute or two, the neighbors would be on their way. They wouldn't be friendly. I wanted to ransack the house for food, but there wasn't time now. I clutched their clothes under my arm, determined to get away with at least that much, and hurried out the door. I stumbled over the rooster's crate and sprawled on the ground. By George, there was food. I yanked the rooster out of his crate and took off in a hard run. I didn't stop running until my lungs ached and my legs seemed ready to buckle. Then I stopped and fell to the ground to rest. The rooster struggled. I wrung his neck and waited for him to quit flopping. At least he had died for a better cause than someone's sport. I put the Mexican's clothes on over my own. They fitted me better than I had any right to expect. And inside the pocket of the trousers, I found a flint and steel. My situation was still bad, but it was improving. I set out walking, moving in what I judged to be a northeasterly direction. I carried the dead rooster under my arm, for I couldn't afford to build a fire and cook him until daylight came to mask the flames. When it was light, I picked a good thicket and went into the heart of it. Using the flint and steel and strips of cloth, I eventually got a small fire underway. The rooster was much too thin and stringy to be good eating, but this was no time or place to be choosy. Little as he was, he would be the best meal I had had in a long time. I impaled him on a spit, scorched him a little, and ate him. Exhausted, I slept most of the day. Terrible dreams of that awful massacre finally brought me wide awake, trembling. Though still hungry, I had at least had a good rest. With the dark to shield me, I would set out walking. I could walk a long way before morning came again. It was well that I had obtained the coat, for a norther blew in, bringing a cold, drizzling rain. With the bite of cold, hunger came back stronger than ever. That rooster had only whetted my appetite. It was a bad time of the year to find berries, wild fruit, or pecans, for the first were out of season and the others had fallen to the ground to be picked up by the wild hogs, deer, and other animals. That was the ironic thing. All around me flocked an abundance of game, deer, wild turkeys, but without a gun, I was unable to bring any of them to hand. The best I could find was some wild onions. The third night, my luck took a brief turn. I came across a tree where some of the turkeys roosted and managed to get one. Not having seen a Mexican all day, I decided to risk building a fire to cook the turkey. Rain had left the wood wet. It took half the night to cut wet bark away from enough dead timber to have dry wood to burn. I got the turkey partially cooked, then ate it all except the feathers and bones. But much of my safe walking time had been wasted, and there was no telling how far I was from home. Hunger appeased, I decided to do some daylight traveling. The arm was still stiff, but no longer painful except when I put pressure on it. With the new strength that came from a good meal, I was able to put some miles behind me. Instead of looking for a mod of timber when daylight came, I kept on walking. In due time, I came to a river and judged it to be the Guadalupe. It was running high and muddy from the heavy rains. My heart sagged. With this stiff arm, I probably couldn't swim it. It would be a grim joke if I had escaped the firing squad at Goliad, only to drown here, unseen, 100 miles from home. Somehow, I had to find a way across that river, but I had not the faintest notion what to do. I thought of trying to make a raft of some kind, but had never done it before and didn't know just how to go about it. Besides, that current probably would be more than I could handle. It would likely carry me downriver away and then dump me to drown. Well, maybe something would turn up. I started walking upriver. I flattened myself in undergrowth near the riverbank and strained to see. When the horses came in sight, a chill ran down my back. It wasn't Mexicans, it was Indians. Nothing would please a Comanche more than to come across a straggling Texian and lift his hair. I lay flat until they were well past me, moving downriver. Then I arose and left in a hurry. I came at length to a log cabin, or rather, the ruins of one. Only a blackened hull remained with the charred roof caved in. Cautiously, crouching and taking my time, I picked my way through it, alert for sign of life. More than likely, Mexican soldiers had burned the cabin, or Indians had come along and done it. If there had been anything of value inside, clothes, for instance, it was gone now. I had hoped to find something to eat, chickens or a hog or a milk cow's calf that had been left behind. If there had been such, someone had beaten me to it. For me, the cabin was a total loss.
No, not quite. At the riverbank, partially hidden by undergrowth, a small boat lay mostly submerged in the water. A short length of rawhide rope held it to a tree. My one bad arm made it heavy pulling against the current. A determined effort finally brought the boat up out of the river. I turned it over to empty the water out and examined it carefully for sign of a hole. A few minutes' search produced the oars. Now, at least, I was able to cross the river.